Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
I'd like you to join me in welcoming Mary Jane.
Oh, class act, aren't we?
Yeah.
Hi. My name is Mary Jane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary Jane.
First, I really want to thank Lorraine and Maureen, I was in touch with, and the whole committee for inviting me to come here tonight. I appreciate it, and I thank you very much. And Lou, who was on the function committee. Imagine a convention that Lou has something to do with being held in the shopping capital of the world. Coincidence? I think not. But thank you. Thank you very much. And boy, you guys have just made us feel so welcome, so very welcome here coming in. And it is just spectacularly gorgeous. I keep thinking the strength of the hills. It's really nice to be here, and I thank you a lot for it. And a bunch from Rhode Island. Is Rhode Island closed tonight? I think everybody came. I'm from Rhode Island. My home group is the Friday Night Big Book group that meets in Kingston, Rhode Island. Without me, I might add. Right on, indeed. So, greetings from the Ocean State. I grew up in Rhode Island, and that's why I'm an alcoholic. No. I'll blame anything, yeah, for anybody, for anything. Just had an episode of that just very recently. I had this paper that was due, and I didn't have it done. So I called the office, and I said to them, I'm sorry, I don't have my paper done. And so they gave me a reprieve, and they said I didn't have to do it till the following week. And it has to do with AA. So I called my service sponsor, and I said, well, it's really her fault because she let me off the hook. And my service sponsor just wouldn't take that for 1 minute. Oh, yeah, it's her fault because you didn't get your work done. So that's really a thing that I've carried all this long way is blame. So I grew up in Rhode Island, and I don't remember having any real problem with alcohol until probably my junior year in college, and that was still in Rhode Island. During my junior year, I got kicked out of the University of Rhode Island. And from there on, I guess, is really my active alcoholism. The next funny thing that happened, I guess, was that there was a girl in my class who really wanted to be an airline stewardess. And so she left school just because she wanted to go be a stewardess. And so she asked if I would ride down to Providence with her on the bus. And I did, and I filled out the little paper, and I got hired. So it was nice, because I didn't have anything else to do. I'd just gotten kicked out. So I went, the first time I was ever on an airplane was to go to the stewardess school. But worked out okay. And I liked that job. I worked for Eastern. I never made Employee of the Month, but I was employed by them for 6.5 years. And I loved the life. It was just party and a lot of fun. And my drinking then didn't stand out, and it seemed like a good setup. What was happening, though, was that more and more blackouts, and I was getting into a lot of car accidents, and a house, too. I hit a house. But eventually, I wound up missing more flights than I suspect you will ever hear from any other human who has worked for an airline. I missed 13 flights, and I promise you that's just an international record as best I know, because they just do not tolerate that. They really don't. You know, if you're late or you don't show up for work one day, your office is still there. If your work is an airplane and you're late, it's gone. You know, you've caused a big mess. And I was, if I made it at all, I was late. But lots of times I just didn't even make it. So ultimately I got fired. And my attitude genuinely was at that time, gee, I do such a nice job when I go. I don't know what's... There's, yeah, they're just picky. Well, what happened, like we do a lot, is that I fell into a better job. I got a wonderful job. I got a job being a representative for a company that was based in Chicago, and I lived in Annapolis, Maryland by then. And I was supposed to go around and call on hospitals or doctors and tell them about our product line and service it and stuff. And I fell into this kind of a pattern. I would get out of the house. I drank real heavy on the weekend, that's all, just on the weekend, just blotto for the whole weekend. But then as soon as I could get put together by Monday, you know, crack of noon, I was on my way, and I would go and I would make these calls, and then I would get to the hotel room, and I would drink and write these reports, and a lot of it was, of course, phony because I hadn't worked all Monday morning. But I would write my reports, and then I would drink till I either passed out or ran out, and I don't think I ever ran out. But I would just drink till I passed out, and then the next day I would make all my calls, and I would go to the hotel, and I would check in, and write my reports, and drink till I passed out, and the next day I would do that, and Thursday I would do that, and Friday I would do that, and I'd knock off a little early on Friday and get back home to start drinking for the weekend. And you know, I would still be doing that if it hadn't fallen apart. This is pathetic, isn't it? That life was fine with me. That was okay. I was comfortable with that. But what happens is, with active alcoholism, it just falls apart. It backfires. And it wasn't my choice. It just quit working. And then pretty soon I wasn't making it at all on Monday. And I was pretty late on Tuesday. And I didn't do much on Friday either. Ann told you that now I serve as a regional trustee for Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you serve as a trustee on the General Service Board, we meet 4 times a year in New York to do AA's business. The General Service Board is the legal responsibility for running AA. And those meetings are called quarterly weekend meetings. And they're the kind of weekend that I got to be used to. They start on Wednesday, and they end on late Monday. In a way, I've just come full circle. But that's a board weekend now. By this point in time, though, I was alienated from my family. I really was not in touch with hardly anybody. I wasn't talking to people, and I kept working as best I could, but I had to drink to keep working. But I needed to work so that I would make money, so that I could drink, so that I could work, so that I could live. And then I realized I was going to get fired from this job too. And then the whole rest of my world would just fall apart because I didn't see how I could manage any other way. By then I needed to drink to answer the telephone or to take a shower. It was sitting right outside the shower. No matter what I was going to do, I'd say, oh, I better go do whatever, but first I'll have a drink. And that was, that's not social drinking, I don't think. By then, it was just part and parcel of my whole day. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about it and making my plans and make sure I had enough. There were sort of two things going on at that point. I was able to stay well enough wired together to appear occasionally in the world, but my whole life really was holed up in this pathetic little dark apartment in Annapolis, Maryland. And that went on and on and just got worse. Did you ever see the Jelinek chart? Jelinek was one of the early guys who was able to describe alcoholism. And that chart is the one that goes down, 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 down. And he describes all of the things that occur that we do. Yeah. Is that any better? But Jelinek talks about how drinking with inferiors and not recognizing that you're the inferior, but he identified all of these stops along the way that are just so incredibly routine, that is just standard part and parcel of alcoholism. I hit every single one of them. The physical deterioration, the moral deterioration, the not caring, spiritually, just abandoning all hope. And at the bottom of that, there's just a whole bunch of circles. Because that's what happens. It just goes around and around and around and around, and more of the same. And that's about where I was living at that point. My father had gotten sober in AA when I was 12 years old, so I knew about AA. But on one day in Annapolis, I got up from the living room couch, and my pattern was to stop in the kitchen and make a drink and go to the bedroom. Then get up from the bedroom, go to the bathroom, go to the kitchen, get another drink, and go to the living room. And that was my world. And I got up from the living room. I didn't go to the kitchen and make a drink. And I went to the bedroom, and I picked up the phone, and I called AA. It was, honest to God, the very first conscious thought that that was the problem. Up until then, I would have defended my life against anything that you would suggest to me, and most especially if you thought that it had anything to do with my drinking. On the other hand, and you know how there's always the two things going on the other hand, I was looking for help with my life. I was going to doctors. I went to a psychiatrist because of the depression. I was looking for some help. But I would not have talked to you about my drinking. And then all of a sudden, on that one day, I went in and just called AA. Now, I believe that that's God's grace, and I don't know where it came from. But God's grace is the only thing that makes any sense to me as far as understanding what happened. I knew about my father's alcoholism, but one of the things that was always important to me was to make this comparison. You know, my dad got in fights. I didn't get in fights, so I wasn't an alcoholic. I went to extremes to demonstrate that I was not an alcoholic. I don't understand that either. Isn't that a funny thing? I work in the medical field now, you know, and if you say to somebody, well, the lab values are back and we find out that you're a diabetic, they don't sit there and fight with you. They don't say, no, I'm not. I only eat one brownie, you know. But they don't, you know, but that's what we do, you know. You may have a drinking problem. No, I don't. No, I don't. I don't drink. I don't drink like my neighbor, or I don't drink like, you know. I don't know why we do that, but isn't that a funny thing? But it certainly is classic, isn't it? Well, I called up, and the funny thing about me has always been appearances. It's okay with me to die on the inside. I just didn't want to look like it on the outside. That was way more important. And so when I went to my first AA meeting, I got all spiffied up and got all put together. And I drove my car to get there, and it was diagonally across the street. I could have thrown a rock at the I don't know why I did that. I don't know why today, but that's what I did. I got in the car, and I drove around and then went to that meeting, which was diagonally across from where I live. What's my point? I don't know, but that's what I did. And when I went there, it was very important to me to appear to be put together. And I remembered a lot of the jargon, you know, because I'd grown up with it. And so I spent the next 6 months trying to act like the hostess. I didn't really need to be there. And as soon as the amen, I was gone. But, you know, even a really lousy performance like that gave me enormous relief. I got big relief, and I thought, you know, if I really get bad, this would work. This AA is okay. This is terrific. And so I kept going to meetings, but away from meetings, I was traveling around, you know, and I would go and I would have one drink because they said it was the first drink. Or these poor old people who really had to go to AA would talk about the first drink getting you drunk. Well, I knew that wasn't true. So I would go, not for me, maybe for, but I would be three states away and I would have one drink. Or if I was at home, if I was in Annapolis where somebody could see me, I would just eat the olive out of somebody's martini or something like that. You know, I just screwing around with it. And what happened is, in 6 months, I got bad drunk. And I didn't mean to. And I said really, really embarrassing things and acted out real bad. But the worst of it, though, and I could tell, you know, here again, you know, where we talk about these two things that always go on, I could describe my alcoholism by the events and the things that should have caused me real grief and sound kind of flashy. You know, the things that we lose, the things that we wreck. But that's not the killer. For me, the killer all happened on the inside. I was just hollow and empty on the inside. If I was with, we were talking about this sort of at dinner. I became sort of, and I know a lot of us do this, you become a master of if you're with the church crowd, then you just sound like the preacher's wife. If you're with a tough crowd, then you're tougher than they are, you know, whatever. And I was just a reflection of whatever crowd I was with. But when I was by myself, I wasn't anything. And that's pathetic. That's so sick and empty and haunting, and you know there's something seriously wrong with that. And the real destruction was going on the inside. And it is a soul sickness. I really believe that. And that's where I lived. That drunk caused me to, in fear, go back to Alcoholics Anonymous and to pray frantically. When I was driving back to that meeting, the next meeting, I got right back, and on the way over, I prayed that if I were shown who to ask to be my sponsor, I would do it and I would play by the rules. I really was afraid because I wasn't making it in the world, and now I wasn't going to make it in AA either. And I was very, very afraid. I heard a woman talk one time who described how the gates could be closing and she'd be on the outside. And I really felt that. I felt it real strongly that I was going to, that the gates were going to close and I wasn't going to get to come in. And that's the worst of times and the best of times, isn't it? You know, where you just beat out and your defenses are not there. I wasn't the hostess that night, I'll tell you. And during the meeting, I had this overwhelming feeling about this person that I was to ask to be my sponsor. It was very clear. And it was not a person that I would have figured out in my head. Not very impressive. And it was a man. He was a retired Navy captain. And I would not have chosen him because he wasn't one of the leaders, you know. And I'll tell you something else. During this first 6 months, there were three guys in Annapolis who used to run around together. There was Big Bill, Little Bill, and Wild Bill. You know, do you love AA nicknames? Do you just love that? You know, if there's four Toms in the group, then you get Tall Tom, Tom with the green truck, Tom with... I love AA nicknames. But these three guys used to hang out together, and they would go to the jail every Saturday night, and then they would come to the meeting, and I just went to the meeting. But I used to sit there and make real snotty remarks to whoever was around, you know, about, like, well, that's the best reason I could think of not to go to jail, you know, because those guys had come by, you know, and just snotty remarks about anybody. And this Little Bill was missing some teeth, and his grammar wasn't up to my standards. And I would make snotty remarks, either out loud or inside, about this man. When I came back that night to Tuesday night St. Mary's, he was the one who was genuinely kind to me. And that really got me. And that kind of thing gets me still. He didn't know what a snot I was. He was just being a good AA. And he helped. But that night, I was led to go and talk to Mac and ask him if he would be my sponsor. And I did. Poor Mac didn't know what in the world to do with me. Because I really was a jerk. Just a flake, you know. And he was a very orderly man. And besides, besides being younger and whippy and female, he just really didn't know if that was right for him to do. So he said that he would be in touch with his sponsor and that he would get back to me. And he made an appointment with me for that Saturday at 10 o'clock. He would come to my house. And so, geez, I hadn't meant for him to take it that seriously. I thought he'd just say, okay, and then I would be safe. I'd have a sponsor. So he came to my house Saturday morning. And he had this pamphlet with him. He had questions and answers on sponsorship. He had gotten permission from his sponsor. And I'll tell you my roots in AA. Mac was my first sponsor, and his sponsor was a guy named Paul B. from the Washington, D.C. area. Paul's sponsor was a guy named Buck D. from Washington, D.C., and Buck D.'s sponsor was Bill Wilson. So, and Mac told me about my roots, and he said, and don't break the chain. And he was very serious about that and wanted me to tell people that I sponsored their roots. But he came that morning, and it was like a contract that I would agree to his conditions on sponsorship. And that's a good time to get somebody, because I would have agreed to very nearly anything, I believe. And so I did. And one of them was to call every day. And I was still traveling these five states. And I would call him every day. And it was a long-distance call I had to do. So, but I did. I didn't have to think. I just had to meet the conditions. And he told me to keep track of the coincidences that happened during the day and to report those to him, because I didn't know what to say. Hi, Mac, it's me, I didn't drink. But I had to report on the coincidences. And the one that occurs to me is a beauty. I was going from Baltimore to Pennsylvania, and I reached in the back of the car to get my jacket, and it was gone. And so then I looked in the back seat, and my suitcase had been stolen, my jacket, the car had been broken into. So I pulled over, and I was mad. I'm trying to live a clean life. I'm sober, and what does it get you? Your car gets broken into. I was mad. So I got to the hotel, and I went to the dining room, and the waitress came over and asked what she could get for me, and I said, a double Gibson. And she said, I'm sorry, dear, it's election day. And I laughed. I looked her in the eye and I laughed. And I thought, wait till Mac hears this one. It was a reprieve. I didn't make that choice. I made the choice to drink. And I was saved. So I got back to my room and then I realized what I was doing. I saw, it takes me a long time to really see what I'm doing. But he was bringing me through the second step. I was coming to believe that things were happening, not of my own doing. The coincidences, if you will do this, if you will keep track of the coincidences that happen in your life for just not very long, a week, 2 weeks, the evidence just piles up. Something's happening here. And so he didn't tell me that he was having me work through the second step, but I was coming to believe. And I could see changes in other people, so it was occurring. I was hooking in. And the next thing that happened, unfortunately, was that I was starting to feel pretty, you get better. You start feeling better physically and stuff. And my tendency always is to say, okay, God, I think I can take it from here. Don't worry. So I started getting complacent and getting relaxed and stuff. But that scared me. On the one hand, it felt good. On the other hand, I thought,
Oh. You don't do very well with that, Mary Jane. So I thought, well, and we had started a young adult group in Annapolis. I was 29 when I came in. Actually, I was 28, but then, you know, made one more excursion. And so I was 29 when I got sober. I got sober on May 5th of 1968. And this year is 29 years sober in AA. So from here on, I'm half of my adult whole life sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks to AA, praise the Lord. And so, and you know, looking for things that were different, you know, those old guys just really didn't understand. And so we started a young adults group. Not a young people's, a young adults group. And the locals, I found out later, called it the Teeny Boppers, but and warned their pigeons not to go there, too, if you want to know. But there was this other young adults group in Baltimore. So, and I was out of town, but some of my friends from that group went and found out that there was going to be a Young People's International. Now, we thought that we had invented Young People's, but there was an international, and it was going to be in Canada. So this guy sent some flyers to our group with a little note that said, you know, hope you can come to the Ikipa, on to Toronto, Don R. And so I did. I tried to get people from Baltimore and Washington and people to go. Everybody wanted to go. And the closer it came to the day, everybody was backing out. So I drove by myself. I went up there for, it took me 3 days to get from Annapolis to Toronto, and I don't know why that is either, but I had a magnificent experience on the way. Magnificent. I heard Gert Behanna talk one time, who said it was as though she were Siamese twins, and one had to die that the other could live. And during those 3 days, I really felt like that the old guy was just dying. It was. By the time I got there, I was kind of hauling one dead body, and I let it go, and the other started to live. And a funny thing, my name is Mary Jane. I didn't want to be Mary Jane. I thought that was a finky name when I was growing up. I wanted to be Mickey. And so I invented that. That was my nickname. And so my drinking name was Mickey O'Connor. And then when I got sober, I thought, that's a terrible name. You know? So on the way, when I got there, I registered at the hotel as Mary Jane O'Connor. And even my name changed. Everything changed right then. The old person fell away. I know who she is, and I have compassion for her, but it doesn't hurt for me to talk about her anymore. And the new person got to live from that time. I was so grateful for that whole experience. I still had a feeling of being consigned to AA, like incarcerated, or, you know, like, I can't live in the world, but I have to stay in AA and make the best of it. It's going to be terrible, but I have to make the best of it. But when I got to this Young People's Conference, these people from California came swinging in, and they were having a great time. They were enjoying their lives, and it was the first time it looked like, oh, this is going to be all right. You know? I thought, wow, this is really pretty good. And this person who had sent the flyers was one of the speakers. So I went up to him after he talked, and genuinely to thank him, and I said, you're the reason I'm here. You're Don R. from Denver, and you sent flyers to my home group in Annapolis, and I want to thank you. And that was August 3rd of 1968. And we were married on August 29th of 1968. Figure it out. It's about 3 weeks. So in the meantime, Don was from Denver, and I lived in Annapolis. I took him home to meet my sponsor, but then, poor Mac, I did. And so Don flew back to Denver, and I, you know, wound up my work and stuff in Annapolis. And then there were about 2 weeks, and then I flew to Denver, and on the airplane I was thinking, boy, I really hope I recognize him when I get off the plane. But I did. It was nice. So we were married, and Don really was in AA up to here. And I'm very grateful for that. he was the one who started me doing stuff, not thinking that everything should be there waiting for me, you know, like if I deigned to show up, that the coffee should be made and stuff. It never occurred to me that anybody did any work regarding all of that. And so he got me answering phones down at the central office and stuff like that. And but even with that, I made a mistake. I took out kind of an associate membership. And we don't have those. But I was Mrs. Don for a while. If Don thought it was a good meeting, I thought it was a good meeting. If, you know, I used his judgment and I used his values and I didn't say anything. And Don, poor Don, he would walk around saying, we think this or we enjoy that. And inside I'm getting mad saying, you didn't ask me. But I would just stand there, you know. And because then I didn't have to take any of the responsibility either if stuff went sour. I found that out too. And that's in the 12 and 12. Boy, that's a powerful thing. Anyway. I was Mrs. Don for a while, resenting it on the inside, but very happy to have the benefits of it on the outside. And with Don's activity in AA and hot and cold running AAs, there were people in and out of our house all the time. And this was in Denver. I thought they ought to get name badges and pay dues. but it was really an experience. It really was. And I didn't do great with it. Because I was still very, very, very self-centered and selfish. And but still, enough of the good of it rubbed off, and I started to have some of the benefits of wonderful, wonderful people. And some of those early relationships in the old Denver Young People's, I'm glad to tell you, a number of them, a surprising number of them, are still my very, very dear friends today. And we're in touch. We all know where each other is. And that's a remarkable thing. You know, that's a long time. And especially if you took a look at the ragtag bunch we were. You wouldn't have bet a lot of money that many of us would have made it. But then Don thought that we ought to move to Texas because Texas AA, he told me, was just wonderful. And he traveled most of the western United States, and that would be a good location for him. Well, I didn't want to go to Texas. I was getting to like Denver. And Texas, for God's sakes, you know, I grew up in Rhode Island. Texas is, it's hot, and there's bugs, and they talk funny. And Texas, to live, you know, it was just awful. And the week we got there, it set all records. It was over 100 degrees. Now, that's not just during the day. It is unrelenting. It never goes, you know, a day in and day out, 100 degrees. Scorpions, tarantulas, and people, you know, in New England, in Rhode Island, you say, well, come by. But you don't mean for people to come by, right? And if they did, you know, what in the hell are they doing here, you know? Well, in Texas, people say, come by. And they drop by, too. You know? Anyway, I mean, it was just like another world. It was another planet with another language and whole other ways of acting and relating and everything. And it took a long time. I had a really hard time. I would hide. I used to hide. I hid behind trees. I hid in the bathroom. I hid if people were coming. But people were wonderful there, too, to tell you the truth. And eventually it got to me. I came to love the people because despite my snottiness, they were really very, very kind. Pretty soon we built a house there, and it had air conditioning, and that was a little cooler. And our son was born there. He's a native Texan, and we're proud of that. I came to love the people, really, really love the people, fine, open, good people. And I made my first 12-step call down there, and some really wonderful, wonderful things. And there was a couple, Bob and Marcy W., and the enthusiasm of this neighborhood and community really occurred around them. They were wonderful, wonderful people, long-time, enthusiastic, dedicated, sober members. Bob was in AA, Marceline is in Al-Anon. So Bob became my mentor. And I would go to him. But he liked me. And so if I did something bad, he would just say, I wish you wouldn't do that, darling. You know, he couldn't get tough with me. He was just kind, and he had daughters, you know, so I just really, I used it as best I could until I started to get really bad in a mess, and then I found out that that won't hold up very well. Don's ex-wife died, and his children came to live with us, and that was not my plan. And if you didn't do my plan, I didn't act very well. I had, you know, that was not the cruise I signed on for. And if you changed something on me, I acted crummy. And I let you know, the pouting and the, you know, the whole business. So I didn't, you know, nobody asked me if I wanted her to die and those children to come. And I got mad. I was mad at her. I was mad at them. I was mad at the change in my life. And I was still so selfish that I was really a whole lot more of a kid than they were. They were 8, 10, and 12. But then Don drank again. And I was in a mess. I was mad. And I found out then that I didn't have the kind of program that I would have told you I did, because I was, you know, the auxiliary and the associate member. And then if life happens, which it has a capacity to do, and you don't have any program, what do you do? And this person whom you think more of than anybody in the whole world just treats you gently, that won't do it. So he said, one day I went into a rage. Amy, my middle stepdaughter, got ballpoint pen on a bedspread. And I went into a rage. And I realized what a mess I was in. So I called Bob, and I went down to meet him, and I told him that I'd had a rage, and I was in bad shape. And he wouldn't, you know, he didn't think that I did things like that. He thought, you know, I was mad. And he said, but you probably ought to talk to Marceline. And I thought, oh, geez, she's an Al-Anon, for God's sake. You know, I need help. Where's Linda? But I was desperate, too, fortunately. And so I went. I called Marceline and asked if I could come and talk to her. And she saved my butt. That's the woman who became my sponsor and took me through the steps in Texas. And she was just firm. And I think the reason I didn't want to talk to her was because she was a wonderful, beautiful, wonderful lady. And I thought, I'm not going to get to where I tell her real stuff, because she's very nice. But, you know, in our talks together, I found out that she hadn't always been that nice. And she said that working through our recovery program made her into what she was and what I saw. Well, okay. And so we started having talks. We started with me on her doorstep at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning crying. And she would have me come in, and we would talk. And then she led me through the rest of my steps. She's the one who had me write an inventory and take a fifth step with her and take a sixth and seventh and to begin to realize that what it said in the big book was very practical information and was meant to be done and accomplished. And things like, after my fifth step, you know where it says returning home, we took an hour to carefully consider the first five proposals. And to not just read that like it's something and, you know, to just, isn't that interesting in this historical book, but to carefully consider the first five proposals and if I had left out anything to talk to her about it. And she had me do things specifically like to thank God from the bottom of my heart that I knew him better. Well, I didn't even know I did until I got down on my knees and I thanked him from the bottom of my heart that I knew him better. And that's come to be an important thing for me, because every tough thing that I go through ever since, I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know him better, because I do. And now I know that. Now it really is true. It wasn't then. She just had me do stuff. And she always had me do stuff. You know, our program is not a whole bunch of think this way or whistle a happy tune. Our program is do stuff. You know, and you come around. You don't even know why you're doing it. But if you, I absolutely believe with everything in me that we get well on willingness. that if she had told me to go home and make peach ice cream, and I went home and made peach ice cream, and I tried hard, and I did what she said, I would get well. I believe that. So Marcy took me through the steps, and I tried to get Don to go to this place that we knew about in upstate New York called Eastridge. It had been started by a guy named Tom P., who was a running around buddy of Bill Wilson's in the early days. And Wilson credits Tom P. with editing the 12 and 12. And he'd started this community, a very intense community in upstate New York. And I thought, well, if Don would go there, he'd get straight, we'd be okay, everything would be fine. Well, Don wasn't ready. And I was getting crazier and crazier. I was just hanging on. Marceline just kept me wired together. And I didn't want to stay, and I it was a real struggle. So I called up this place, Eastridge. I was 4 years sober at this point. I called them up, and I said, I haven't been drinking, but I'm crazy as a loon. Could I come there? And they said, sure. So I signed on for their basic stay, which was 2 months. And I left Texas on Father's Day, which I thought was really kind of a I left Don, I left the house, I ran away. I went up to Eastridge Community in New York, and I stayed there for the basic 2 month stay. Another very, very, very fortunate, meaningful thing for me. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you started chanting from the Psalms, you ran a mile, you started peeling the carrots for lunch, you didn't smoke, you didn't drink coffee, from the time you hit there, you became a member of their community, and it was that intense, and I needed it desperately. And they helped a great deal, and I think about them a lot, too. If you acted out bad, you had to consider what it was, the nature of your wrong, and then you had to make a big sign and hang it around your neck on a string, and mine was, I am sneaky and defiant. That's me, folks. And that was the root of the deal, too. They helped me a lot, though. It got me to where I could go back to Texas as a person who could live with the cards I'd been dealt. The kids got the benefit of our AA experience, so they made out pretty good, and we're close today. But mainly, I got to go back and not run, which was very different from me. If something was tough for me, I would lie and I would run or drink. And so this time I wasn't lying and I wasn't running, so I didn't have to drink, and it was big. I got back to Texas. Don eventually had a breakthrough, a grace period, and so he went up to Eastridge. And he did get well. But Don, like I told you, got into everything up to here. So he called me from Eastridge, and he said, I think we're going to have to come live here and be members of this community.
Well, no, we don't.
That's the emergency room. You don't live there, you know. I mean, they didn't eat meat. It was just awful. No TV, no nothing, you know, nothing. So 2 months, sure, I can do that. But he decided that it would be a good place for us to live and rear the children and all that. So he bought a house while he was there and brought me home a Polaroid. He said this, you know, oh, geez, it was terrible. And I don't move well, you know. I made my peace with Texas. And that was just about the time that Don said we're going to move to New York. I had come to love the people in Texas. But here we go, off to way upstate New York. Did you ever hear Calicoon? You did. Somebody heard of Calicoon. Well, we didn't live in Calicoon. We lived outside of Calicoon. There was a littler town named Hankins. Nobody heard of Hankins, right? Well, we didn't even live in Hankins. We lived outside of Hankins. There were 97 people in this town. And I went to my first AA meeting up there because I agreed what I said to Don at the time was, you can go be a member of this community. The kids and I will live down the hill. We'll live there, and you go be a member of the community. But I'm not going to join up with that. So that's what we did. And I went into town to go to an AA meeting. And it was in the basement of a bank, and there were three guys in there talking about how tough it was to get a job, and a lady who smoked cigars. And that was the AA group.
So I went home crying. I'm driving home crying. I'm going to call Marceline and tell her this isn't going to work. I'm not going to make it here. You can't live there. You know, who could do that? So I told her, you know, they don't even know about the book, Marcy. It's a rumor up here. She says, well, you go next week and bring your book. She always told me stuff to do, you know. So I did. And that turned out to be just fine, too. I have become so enriched by the people who were good to me when I wasn't very good to them. And what a rich, rich, rich AA experience it had been by then. By then I was 10 years sober. Don decided that the community really wasn't too great to live in. So he wanted to go back into advertising, and he wanted to move to Nashville, Tennessee, because that was a great location for his work. And I'd had it. And we'd been married for 10 years, and it had run out of gas. The marriage had taken a lot of beating, and so we separated at that point. Don moved down to Nashville. I took our son, Brian, who was then 5, and went back to school. I don't think I have time to tell you about the incredible miracle of my getting back into school, but it was. That year, 10 years sober, was the worst year and the best year because it was too much for me to do, so I couldn't do it. And that works out great. I just prayed my buns off. And I got back to school, sold the house, the divorce. I went off the scale on, you know, those insurance things, you know, where they tell you about how many points you get for all different kinds of stress. I went right off the scale. But it was wonderful because I really couldn't do it. And I got back to school, and it was remarkable. And my first report card, I called Bob White back in Texas, and I said, Bob, I think you'd be proud. And he said, I already was. And that was a revelation to me. That was one of those things I learned, was that I didn't need to keep proving myself and earning my place here. You don't do that in AA. You just be and pass it on, you know. I don't know where some of this stuff is coming from, but it's just stuff that occurs to me that I want to tell you about. After 2 years, I graduated. I got a special award at graduation. This is a funny thing. They said it was a special award for Mary Jane. I was 20 years older than everybody in my class. It was weird. And nobody said what the award was for. Is that funny? They just said, this is a special award for Mary Jane. But we are different as a result of this program, aren't we? You know, I was different, and I was different in the best way I could imagine. So then I got a job. Brian and I moved to Illinois. I got a job with a big VA hospital, and we were making out okay. Then Don, my ex-husband, and I gradually put a better thing together than we had at the end of our marriage. We became very good friends. And he still was one of the biggest influences in my whole life. We spent holidays together, and it was a very good thing. It was an enriching thing. I got a telegram out there saying that they were looking for a physician assistant in peripheral vascular in the VA hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. Well, that was a description of me. So I thought, it's time to go home, and so I did. And that was in 1985. I went to the International in Montreal, came home, threw some stuff in a bag, and off we went. We moved back to Rhode Island, and that's been marvelous. It's just been everything. I can see the restoration in a better way in Rhode Island. Because of the places that I had lived, I had never been active in service, but I've been sober for a long time. So in Pennsylvania, even in school, they elected me the GSR. I didn't know what the GSR was. I didn't know that it was the General Service Representative who was the link from my group to all of AA. I didn't know that, but I was 10 years sober, so I just dummied up. I said, sure. And that, you know, and so I did it, and I hated it. The service stuff was terrible. The people were mean, and a business meeting, I mean, like, you got to go to your group business meeting, but an extra one a month, you know, and it was awful. So I was glad to get rid of, you know, I was glad when that was over with. But when I got back to Rhode Island, I found a home group, And one night this woman came and she said, you know, this group does not have a GSR. And you're not hooked on to all of AA. But we're making decisions for your group. And she invited us to participate in AA. And I thought, that's right. And besides that, by then, some of the fog had lifted. And I felt an obligation always. The main thing that Bob White had always said was, the extension of gratitude is action. You can sit around all night and talk about how grateful you are, but what's the evidence? If you really are grateful, then you demonstrate gratitude. Don't talk about it. Pass it on. Do some of the tough stuff. Show up. Be responsible. Take a job. Do things. Your name has to be on a 12-step list and stuff like that. But the extension of gratitude is action, not being able to talk inspiringly about gratitude. So I really was affected by that. That woman is here tonight, and she's a past delegate from Rhode Island, and is Betty Mack. When she was the district committee member in Rhode Island, she went to every group in the district and described the service structure and invited groups who were not hooked on to participate. And so I became the GSR from that group. And then I got, you know, I'd done stuff like coffee and stuff. I knew that part. But this time, it opened a whole new world to me, a whole new world. I realized how many jobs there were that you couldn't do from your home group. But if enough groups got together, we could have a corrections committee. We could pool some of our resources. We could gather books. We could do things as committees that one group couldn't do all by itself. So I got the hang of this, the whole service structure, and why it was important, and to care about the preservation of AA, not just to say, I got mine, you do the best you can. You know, to care that AA will be there and in good shape for whoever walks in the door next. They should have the same chance that I had. AA should be in as good a shape for them as it was for me. AA was in as good a shape for me to get me sober, to change my life. And that's all I have to do is to make sure to do my part that's in as good a shape as it can be for the next guy. So pretty soon I started to serve on the cooperation with the Professional Communities Committee. And we talked to shop stewards. And we did stuff to try to get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to professionals who were likely in the course of their work to encounter active alcoholics. You can't always do much of a job at that from your home group, but if you get together as committees in a whole area, you know, you can do pretty good. And so I got really interested in that. And then they asked me if I would chair it, and I said no. I was going into the hospital. I didn't want to. I didn't want to. I was still, you know, I was scared. But I was going into the hospital for an operation, and I said, I really would love to, but I really couldn't. It wouldn't be fair. So they said, that's okay, we'll wait. You know, when you get feeling better, then you can do it, and we'll tough it out till you get ready. Well, I was ready very soon, you know. So I got to chair it for 2 years, and that was, you know, that was showing up and planning meetings and going out of my way. It wasn't always convenient, but that's the deal, isn't it? So then I stood for area delegate, and I got elected. And that was really something. I got to be the delegated person from Rhode Island to go to the annual General Service Conference in New York every April, you know, where the 92 people who are delegated from their areas in the U.S. and Canada come together to discuss any issue that could affect all of AA. Big stuff. I was in. I felt like Alice. You know, I'd fallen down the rabbit hole. It was Wonderland for me. It was really, really awesome. And I don't have time to tell you all of that. But then, you know, I came back, and you automatically get to be the state convention chair in Rhode Island. And so I got to do a year of that. All of this stuff is really, it goes against my nature. I always wanted to be the second banana. I wanted to be there in the group of people who were doing things, but if it went sour, I didn't want you to blame me. So I didn't want to be the chairman of anything. I didn't want to be the, you know, and I wanted the credit. But I had to go against my nature, and I think that that's a very spiritual thing. That makes spiritual changes in us when we're willing. Nothing moves me more than to see somebody stand up at a microphone at like a forum or something, and they'll say, and they're shaking so bad that they're knocking into the mic and everything, and they're saying, I don't want to be up here, but I have to say blah blah. It warms my heart because they're going against their nature, and they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it because they believe that that's what they're supposed to be doing for AA, and they'd rather be sitting down, but they do it anyways. And there's a lot of things in AA that we don't want to do, but you do it anyways. And it's the doing it anyways that we grow and gain by. After that, they asked if I would be willing to let my name stand for trustee. And I said, sure. Never dreaming that there was the most outside possibility, not the most remote possibility, that I would get elected. And I was. So that's my service job right now, is to serve on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is, and it's tough, it's hard work, but nothing has brought me greater, unbelievable, I'm not even going to be able to come up with the word. It means a lot to me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is my value system, it is the position I take in life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't mean going to meetings every night of the week. Lots of times you hear people described like, oh, God, he's a good AA. He's at AA he's at a meeting every night. Maybe he is, maybe he's not, I don't know. But there's other things to AA. It has caused me to see the world and my loved ones in a whole different way. These are and they're very hard to describe. I could tell you that I got a better job or a house or a car. You know, those things are easy to describe. And in a way, they give you an idea that our lives are better. And that's usually what we wind up having to, that's the best thing we got to describe. But the real change, just like the deterioration of alcoholism takes place so badly on the inside, the real recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous takes place on the inside, too. And it doesn't show necessarily. You know, I don't look that much different. Baggier and wrinkled, I guess, but I don't, you know. But I know what has occurred on the inside of me. And it's astounding. I wasn't any great shakes before I drank. What AA has done in my life will never, ever, ever be able to be repaid. So what I got to do is I just got to keep trying to pass it on as best I can. The problem with that is you pass it on and you get more rewards. You get more good stuff. So then you feel an obligation. So you do more and then you get more. You know, it's on end. But I'm delighted to have the job that I have in AA now. I'm delighted to have the relationships that I have with my family. They trust me. I know that they love me. And always what's been nicer is to have people to love and to care about, genuinely care. I don't just make the noises anymore. I don't just... I always knew the words to say, but underneath I knew I didn't really mean it. And I didn't think I was capable of love, and I thought I was some kind of a monster on the inside. And it's not true. I do love. I love people. I love my friends. I love my family. So much has changed. And then I think, well, did AA throw out that whole other person? No, I don't think so. I think that it helped me get rid of stuff that I never was anyways. Harold, I just heard a guy, Harold G., a past trustee, talk, and his sponsor had told him, keep getting rid of all that stuff that's no longer serving you, and maybe you'll show up. Isn't that an interesting way to think about it, though? Because it was all added on junk. It wasn't me. It was defenses. It was things it was little postures that I had adopted. It wasn't me anyways. And so more of me can show up now and be with you, genuinely be with you. This is me. And that's very nice, because I wasn't ever me. But I'm glad, and the more integrated I am, which is that I'm the same person at work, or at home, or at church, the more I'm the same, the more integrated, that's the same root word as integrity, and the opposite of disintegrate. And so things like that have come to have meaning for me. And guess where I learned all of that stuff? In AA. My friends laugh because I say I haven't had an original thought in 25 years. And I haven't. And it works a lot better that way. Everything I know, I've learned in AA. Or at least I've put new interpretation on stuff that I already knew. But now I see it better. Because I experience it. And it's mine. And I've seen it demonstrated. Just showing up. And it's an opportunity for me to get to share some of that with you. And this is, I guess it's not really related to much, but I just want to tell you, it looks as though I'm just standing here by myself tonight, but I'm not. There's so many people standing here with me. You know, there's Mac, and little Bill, and Marcy, Don, some people who are here, some people who have lit up my life, showed me that it was how worthwhile this life is, and it really, really is. I'm grateful to be here with you. Thank you kindly.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.